This week on the BOAG World Show, we give you some tips on how to run successful usability testing and how best to introduce multivariate testing. This week's show is sponsored by Balsamiq and Full Story. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of conversion rate optimization, user experience and digital transformation. My name is Paul BOAG. I don't have time to introduce Marcus Lillington because really this is just interrupting me wanting to play Red Dead Redemption.
But oh right, is it any good?
It's freaking amazing! It is incredible. It is the evolution of gaming.
Really?
It is just such a pleasure to play, I tell you. That's all I've been doing this week. Well, since I've got back from Estonia. Which, by the way, Estonia is an amazing place. Go to Estonia, Marcus.
I think I'd like Estonia very much. I've got an image of it being kind of a bit of a party place. But with lots of kind of history.
Yeah, I mean, so I went to Tallinn,
yeah.
Right? Best food. Seriously, better than the food I had the week before in New York. Unbelievably good food.
Okay.
So cool. That was the first, not that it's all about the food, but it is mainly about the food.
Yes, I'd second that.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw some history and shit, but the food was amazing.
So we went to a museum and there was these priceless works of art, but steak we had after was amazing.
Exactly. you understand the priorities.
That reminds me, can you remember when you and I ended up having an afternoon free in Rome?
Yes.
And we'd never been to the Vatican.
Yeah.
So we ended up getting a taxi and it was like, God, we've got like 2 hours or 3 hours. So that
yeah.
kind of thing. Anyway, various funny things happened. But we were jumped on immediately as we got out of the taxi and I thought we were going to be murdered as we were walking around behind.
That felt, very dodgy.
Just come with me because we've got to go to the office where I'll hand you on to the other person.
Down this dark alley. Yeah.
Anyway,
We didn't die.
But what we were talking about reminded me of the fact is when you were walking around, I think it was about a tenth of the museum, and it was like, and here is this 2,000-year-old marble statue in perfect condition. If it had a monetary value, it would be the same as the sun. And here's another marble statue in perfect condition. Da-da-da-da. So, yeah, you just got a bit blasé.
You got to the point of like, get it over with. You became punch drunk with decadence and history and wonder. But no, I really liked Tallinn a lot. All I knew about Estonia before I went was that that's where Pipe Driver based, who is a web app that I use, and it's got quite a big internet community. Got to say, loved it. Really loved it. Really good city. Very interesting. But not as interesting as Red Dead, which is much better. So
Why? What's so good about it? Come on, tell me. I'm not convinced. But how much does it cost, for starters?
Oh, it's about 50 quid. Okay. But there's well over 100 hours worth of gameplay in it.
Okay.
The main storyline is 60 hours, and I'm not even partway through. It's a really engaging story. You get to know the people in your camp, in your outlaw gang, very well. You discover little stuff about them. Even the side quests are really fun and entertaining and enjoyable. But it's the richness of the world that blows you away. It's the attention to detail that is just staggering. I mean, you can go into all kinds of ridiculous details.
The cow's testicles, didn't you? Or the horse's, yes.
The horse's testicles, yeah. But, you know, you skin all the animals accurately. You have to clean your guns. And it's got this... it's quite a slow-paced game. You know, you have these moments of intense violence and you know, kind of action. But then in between that, it's a lot of riding around, you know, enjoying the world. And it's just stunning. It's just absolutely stunning. I can't stop playing it. So this podcast is a massive distraction.
Okay. Well, so I reckon, should we aim for the shortest podcast we've ever done?
Well, except that I've got a bit of a problem.
Oh, okay.
That is driving me nuts, and I need you to make a decision for me, Marcus.
Right? Okay. I'm normally quite good at these. It'll be the wrong one, but hey.
It'll be the wrong decision, almost certainly. But you see, this is my problem, right? So I need, it's the old, I need a lightweight laptop to carry me around with, you know, to go to conferences and do that kind of stuff. And I was hoping the new MacBook Air was going to be the magical answer for me.
Yeah.
But actually, it would be a good all-round computer for most people. But I've got my iMac that I sit using at my desk.
Yep.
And I need just something lighter weight. So I'm either looking at the MacBook, which is obviously even lighter and even smaller.
Yep.
The little tiny one. Or the new iPad Pro.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't make up my mind. Because on one hand, the iPad Pro is half the weight. It's mm-hmm. £200 cheaper. It's smaller form factor. It's all those things. But it's an iPad Pro. So it's not as good for actually doing, you know, more complex kind of graphic type stuff. You know, most of the time I'm just kind of editing a keynote file, doing some emails or writing.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't know. I don't know which to get. They've really messed up their product lineup, Apple have. It's all over the place now. You used to know what you were supposed to buy. I liked it when Steve Jobs told me what I had to buy. Now they're giving you choice, and I'm just confused.
I agree. I feel like I'm being, they deliberately won't make the one I need. You know what I mean? It's kind of like,
yeah.
I've got the MacBook Pro now, the 13-inch. It's too heavy.
Yes.
The battery runs out on it too quickly.
Yes. But
my old Air was the best machine that's ever been made.
Well, why don't you get the new Air? Because that would be a good one.
I don't need one, but I will.
All right.
When it's time to come around, I will definitely go back to an Air, because this is just pointless. I mean, it's probably better for, when we're doing things like this, like I'm on video, I'm recording and that kind of thing, then yes, all right, this is a better computer. But for the majority of the time, it's way better. But I will help you with your decision, Paul. Firstly, you bought an iPad Pro and you sold it. So, not good. They're too big. They're too big to
I wouldn't. No, no, I wouldn't get the massive one. I wouldn't get the big one. I'd get the smaller of the two.
Is that the same? Oh, yeah, that's the same size as a normal iPad.
Yeah, normal iPad size.
Nah. Just get.
No, you think get them out. Yeah,
yeah. Because if you sat down in an airport, that's when you want it, isn't it? If you're set slobbing on a seat at an airport, and you've got to get that sort of funny sit-on keyboard working on your lap, it's never going to work.
They are better. They're supposed to be better than new one, but I do tend to agree. I think I need a little, and it's really nice, a little iMac. Even though everybody's saying, why would anybody buy that now and not the MacBook Air? Which I can kind of understand, and that's
true. Is there a little MacBook Air? Is there like an 11-inch one like they used to?
No. Right. So you've got the 13-inch MacBook Air, and then an 11-inch MacBook. And it's like, I honestly don't, you know, in some ways it's silly buying the 12-inch MacBook because it's actually more expensive.
Yeah.
Than the MacBook Air, bottom of the line. But it's got, it's such a mess. I can't believe how messy their lineup is. You know, basic, talking about conversion rate optimization, you know, the one thing you don't want to do is lead people to choice paralysis. And that's where I'm at the moment. I honestly don't know what to buy. And I think most people feel like that, whatever level they are within, you know, Apple's lineup.
What was the point? I mean, and this is another a major point for them, as far as kind of their sales process or how they feel that they should be, you know, the angle they should be taking is they've gone almost twice the price.
Yeah,
have you noticed that? I mean, we're not all as rich as you, Paul, but you know.
I don't look at prices, but I understand that normal people do.
Yeah, see, exactly. But you can spec a 15-inch MacBook Pro up to about $6,000 now. Which is just bananas. Just that is insane. Yeah. So put Lee, because you know what Lee's like, who's been on this show a number of times, so incensed that he went out and bought a Windows machine and then charged it to the company. But he's now gone back to Windows because it's ridiculous.
Well, I'm getting pretty close to that myself because, you know, I look at something like the Microsoft Surface, which gives you all the benefits of an iPad Pro with a proper operating system on it.
True, but it's still too heavy.
I don't know.
We've got one here. And it's great. It's great. To use as a computer, a lovely thing, but as a to sit on your lap thing, it's a big chunk.
Oh, is it?
Well, yeah.
Fair enough. Anyway, Marcus.
Yes, we've gone off.
What's your thought for the day?
Right. My thought for the day isn't my thought for the day.
Oh.
It's somebody else's thought for the day.
You're now telepathic, are you? You're channeling other people's thoughts.
Basically, I asked Dan a couple of weeks ago. I said, I've done all this stuff about the Headscape website. And I've only got two more shows to go left on the series. And I've said nothing about any of the kind of back-end development that we did.
Right.
So can you just give me a few bullet points? And he wrote an entire blog post on it.
Excellent. So there you go.
The link in the show notes. It's the latest blog post on the Headscape site, which I will just quickly kind of go through, which might sound a bit weird, me being him at times, but I'll try and translate it into me talking as if it was me talking
about
it.
We could have just got him on the show, couldn't we? That would have probably
been more sensible.
He's actually
out there, but I thought of it like 10 minutes before it was time to go, and I think Dan would have probably hit me with something if I'd said, do you want to be on the show at that point?
Yeah.
That close to it.
He's not a great fan of that, is he?
No. But
now, this is interesting, because this is about Gutenberg, is it?
It is, yes.
Oh, now this is something I've been stoically avoiding, so I'm interested in this.
Yeah, it's quite... I mean, I have certain opinions about kind of the usability of it and all that kind of thing, but mostly I just said, you did the majority of the back-end work on the new Headscape site, so tell me all about it.
Yeah.
So the big thing was sort of experimenting with Gutenberg Editor to see what it was like. Mm. I'm going to read this verbatim. This is the important disclaimer at the top of the blog post. I was reluctant to provide any thoughts in writing because, for reasons that should become quickly evident, any opinion I express now will almost certainly be out of date by the time I finish writing it.
that feeling.
Yeah, exactly. It was particularly the case with Gutenberg at the time. Anyway, I'm not. Because it's about to become part of WordPress, which I think maybe I should say what it is, but everyone listening to this is going to know what it is, aren't they? I don't know.
I would have thought so. Gutenberg is a new WYSIWYG kind of build your own page editor within WordPress, very much like Squarespace and that kind of thing.
Yeah, kinda.
Basic.
Yeah, when we did the Headscape site, it wasn't part of WordPress. I don't think it still is. It's very soon.
It's going to be any minute now. Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, so as you know, we've recently redesigned our site. The kind of goal of doing that was threefold. One was to update the design, making some performance improvements. It's kind of the threefold. From a technical point of view, the second one was to decouple the site from the Bioware World site, so Paul could play with his site without breaking the Headscape site.
Yeah.
And thirdly, to experiment with Gutenberg to see how we got on with it.
Yeah.
So, just to quickly look at the first two of those points. One, the simpler things that had a really big impact on performance. I say we in the sense of Dan did.
Yeah, Dan.
And Ian, was to basically lazy load a lot of the content, including the huge image heavy work listing page. We also set up, we're using a caching tool app thing called Varnish now.
I know Varnish, yeah.
Yeah, which gives you great performance gain. So that was quite easy things that we did there. Apparently, according to Dan, the decoupling from Bioware was super simple.
Good.
Yeah, impressed at how well the built-in WordPress import-export tool worked, and basically took all the content off and started again fresh with the new site.
But I tell you what, even the because we had a multi-site installation of WordPress, which they were joined together. Even after you'd done that and we turned off the multi-site for Boa on the original installation, because you set up a new one for Headscape, even that was pretty painless. Mm. No major issues. We were all a bit terrified it was going to break, but it was fine. So,
and I'm kind of doing explanation of Dan's post here, but one of the angles that we liked WordPress a lot. It works. Mm. The documentation, I'm told, is really good. Mm. But obviously with this new thing that they said, this is how it's going to be, that was changing so often, it was quite a tricky process getting it up and running. So I'll just kind of go through each of Dan's points. Getting used to Gutenberg and working out what we could and couldn't do and should and shouldn't do was the major part of the kind of technical aspect of the project.
Yeah.
And he says that he's using it as the reason, he's using Gutenberg as the scapegoat for anything that might not mean that the site isn't as perfect as it possibly
should be. Oh, I see. Right. Yeah.
But I think it's actually...
wise man.
It's actually fair. Because, lovely quote, building with Gutenberg in any way at the moment feels a lot like trying to build a house of cards in a light wind while someone imposingly stands behind you revving up a leaf blower every so often just for the sake of it. And he says he doesn't like to work like that. So... it's,
no shit.
to give you a kind of like my sort of experience of this is we'd set up something because we'd set up the styling on a block because it's all in blocks. You kind of you divide up your content into text blocks, image blocks, all that kind of thing, and you can kind of move them around, do stuff with them, which I initially found really quite fiddly, but it took me about 2 hours and then it was really easy. So the one thing to mention on that is Gutenberg, I think, is a very easy editor to use. But that's just kind of my kind of front end user of it. But what kept happening is I'd start working on it the next day and all the captions had moved from left aligned to center. For example, that would just be one thing. I said, what's going on there? And Dan is looking at me, no idea. And then he'd come back the answer, oh, they've just changed Gutenberg.
Right.
Full stop. Because I think there were so many updates happening all the time. We were working on this thing that would change, the kind of settings and the things that we thought were nailed down. So that was kind of like the particularly hard thing. I'm jumping all over the place, so I just need to catch up to... where I've got to. So basically Dan's saying that he's glad we used Gutenberg to get a feel for it from a content editor point of view and from a kind of developer and themer perspective. And he's pleased with what we've thrown together that the world sees. Mm-hmm. But he said it still needs some polishing from a back end point of view, basically because we were dealing with this thing that just changed constantly.
Yeah.
It said it was also good because on the bigger projects we've done over the last few years, they've all been Drupal. We've done some smaller WordPress stuff, but doing this project kind of gave us the insights into being more confident working with WordPress effectively.
Yeah.
And we are now kicking off a new WordPress site for a client that we would 6 months ago would have definitely done in Drupal. So it was a certainly worthwhile thing to do. The lesson that we've learnt, I guess, that I'm going to finish on here is that there's still a kind of major debate on whether we should be managing entire page layouts in one WYSIWYG, because that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And because that's how it works, it's great on a kind of like a kind of content page, a blog page. It's brilliant for that sort of thing. But if you want a kind of more of like maybe a landing page where you've got content left and right and or you know different widths and all that kind of stuff, it's as Dan puts it, don't expect miracles just yet because it's really hard to do that kind of thing. So
yeah,
that's our thoughts on Gutenberg.
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of struggled with it a little bit. I had a bit of a look at it, and it depends on the viewport you're looking at it from. Because if you're looking at it from a developer point of view, it makes me very nervous, mm-hmm. Because if they make an update to WordPress, it can easily break what I'm doing. Also, what's the quality of the code that it's producing? I mean, I haven't looked into it a huge amount. But from a content creator point of view, it's like, yay, this has got a lot of potential, especially as you can create things like custom blocks where you can, add in your own stuff into it. So,
but I soon found out there was saying, oh, can I'd like this page to be like, we got a couple of kind of custom-y pages on the site, which are more like... Yeah, they're one-offs. And I was like, oh, can I do this? Can I do that? And it was like, that's a bit trickier. So actually, let's not bother with Gutenberg at all for those pages. And then it's like, well, if you're not going to do that, what's the point in it? Maybe use it for some things and not others. But maybe it's just early days. I know that it's got some major bad press. And I suppose what we're saying here is it's not as bad as all that, but it was quite a challenge.
I think it's like anything when they worked very much in the open with it and they put it out there very early, and I think it's got a lot better more recently. I don't think I'm going to be when they you know, roll out Gutenberg to begin with, I think I will go back to the original editor, because I tend to write stuff in, you know, in HTML anyway. But maybe when I next redesign, I would, you know, work with custom blocks from scratch. I don't know. I'm interested. It's of interest to me, but I'm not rushing into it. Okay, that's cool. Thank you very much for that, Marcus.
I'm typing stuff and I'm going to say it. Anyway, Andrew in the chat room says, what would you say are the major benefits of WordPress are over Drupal, or is that another podcast in and of itself? Yes, I can't answer that now quickly, but it's given me some thoughts for thoughts of the day for the next series. Thank you, Andrew.
Okay, let's talk about Balsamic very quickly. So this month I am sitting down and going to be recording four initial impression videos of various people's sites. So where I'm going to review four sites and I'm going to give my feedback on them of how they could be improved, how they could be made better, what user experience enhancements you can do, all of that kind of good stuff. And I can do that because of the lovely guys at Balsamic that are making that possible. And they're currently collecting submissions for sites that I could review. So if you have a site that you'd like me to check out, you can go to balsamic.com/learn/BoagReview. And if you submit your website there, I will have a look at it. And maybe yours will be the one that I choose to review and give some feedback from. If, however, you haven't got a website in place, or you're looking at redesigning or something like that, and you could just do with some help about knowing, you know, how to approach the redesign, maybe some help doing some wireframing and that kind of thing, Balsamic actually offer you the opportunity to get personal help on doing that wireframing, and get someone from Balsamic to work with you doing that absolutely free of charge, which is pretty awesome. You can apply by emailing them at userresearch@balsamic.com. So I'm really quite impressed at these guys, you know, how much they're doing, just giving away and encouraging, trying to improve the quality of the sites that are out there. So yeah. And I met some guys from Balsamic recently. I can't remember where that was. Was that in New York? Anyway, they're so lovely. They're lovely, lovely people. Anyway, that's Balsamic. So in this episode, in this penultimate episode in the season, we're looking at the subject of testing and how important testing is.
On that subject, Paul, sorry to interrupt, but no, you said to me ages ago, so we'll be going up to Christmas. So I've got in my notes, for which I haven't written yet, I need to come up with a Christmas thought for the day on Thursday, the 8th of November. No. On the 8th of November.
No, that is incorrect. No, we're going to do...
It was all lies.
Yeah, we record the last one on the 8th, right. Although it doesn't go out on the 8th. It goes out the week after. Mm. But we're going to do a Christmas... Remember, we're going to do a virtual party just in here.
Oh yeah.
Right. In here being crowdcast. So only for live. We won't put that out as a podcast because it will be irrelevant crap. But you I will announce the details of that on Thursday's show the next show.
Yep.
If I don't forget. Cool. But we're going to come up with something. Is it all right if I carry on now?
Well, I'll probably think of something. Obviously, I can't think of anything right now. You'll have to start talking about something, and then I'll want to interrupt you.
Well, if you feel the need to interrupt me, go ahead. But I think that might just be the end of the show because, you know, Red Dead.
Red Dead. You want to go and ride your horse, don't you?
I want to ride on my horse. More importantly, I want to stand behind my horse waiting for the exciting moment when it takes a crap. Which it does at random intervals. And it's like, yeah! No, sorry. Anyway, grown-up professional podcast. Testing. We want to talk about testing. Now, we touched a little bit on testing in previous episodes, but I want to look specifically at usability testing and how to make that success.
Mm.
And then later on, we're going to look at multivariate testing. But let's look at usability testing first. First and foremost, most important thing that I can say is you should be doing usability testing. But I do completely understand that it's really quite hard to do. It's easy to say it it's difficult to make it happen.
Depends what you mean. What do you mean?
Ah, yeah. Exactly. It could be dead, dead simple. It doesn't need to be complicated. It doesn't need to be onerous. But it can sound so intimidating. The most important thing, actually, is not just to test once, but to test multiple times throughout a project. But just keep it really, really lightweight. Because the thing is, the more you test, the more issues you're going to find. But also, the more you test, it means the earlier you're testing. And the earlier you're testing, the better it is. If you test right at the end of a frigging project, it's too late to change anything. You're not gonna want to change stuff at that late date, and it's going to be hard to change. You want to test really early on. You can test absolutely anything. You can even test a sketch. For example, you can do a first click test. So you could take a design comp, right? And you could literally ask people, if you were trying to do dot, 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 where would you click first, right? That's it. That's all you need to ask them.
And you could ask, I mean, you could ask your colleague in the desk next to you. All right, they are a web professional. Yep. You can ask your wife.
Your wife is a good one. You know? Your friends, children, random people on the street. Mm-hmm. Preferably somebody outside of the company, I say.
Yeah.
You know, because they know the jargon and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, pretty much anybody. Yes, it's better if it's demographically perfect people and all the rest of it. But testing with somebody is better than nothing. Mm. And something like a first click test literally takes seconds. And if someone gets their first click right, the chances are they're going to end up being able to complete the task. Statistically, I think it's something like 85% of people who complete the first click. Clicks correctly end up being able to do their task. There are also services. This Usability Hub is a really great service, right? Usability Hub, they'll even recruit people for a first click test for you. Okay, yeah, of course you have to pay a bit if you do that, but you could just use your social media people as well, you know, the people you've got that you do you know, on your that follow you on social media. Just go ahead, create a little test and shove it on social media. First click test, get results straight away. Perfect. Right. So start early. Very, very important. Test often. Very important. Don't worry about getting the first perfect participant. Anybody will do. The only exception is if you're talking about an audience like children or those with disabilities or the very elderly, because they have specific cognitive or physical, you know, disabilities that can change the way they interact. But most people respond in a fairly similar way to usability hurdles, right? Of how to use a website.
Yeah, it's more sort of if you're asking questions about does aesthetics. A design reflect the character of an institution, then you would need to have representative testers. But yeah, if it's like, can you see the thing? Then yeah, human will normally do.
Exactly. Yeah. Can you see the thing? That's a brilliant way of putting it. You don't need to test with a lot of people as well, right? So Jacob Nielsen famously talks about anything over about 5 or 6 people, and actually you get diminishing returns. But even if you just test with 3 people, right, that allows you to get something like 75% of issues, okay? Mm. Right. So you think about that. 3 people, say an 40 minutes each with 20 minutes in between. So that's an hour in total. That's 3 people. You can do 3 people in a morning, right? Mm. So it only needs to take a morning. Then you can sit down over lunch and decide what you want to do. Very straightforward, right? You don't need any fancy facilities either or clever software. All you need is a laptop and something like GoToWebinar or Skype or something like that, Zoom, where you can record a session. So you can record the screen and you can record what people are doing on camera. You can have someone sitting in another room watching that session so that people can watch it live. Simple as that. There are other tools out there. There's a great tool that I really love using that makes it a little bit easier called lookback.io. I say it's lookback.io. I always wonder whether I get... No, I got it right. Yeah, lookback.io, which is a really useful tool for doing both in-person and remote testing as well, because, you know, often it's hard to get people in a room So by using something like Skype or Zoom, you can talk to people anywhere. So again, fancy facilities required.
I'm being an actual punter here because I'm doing a lot of testing next week. What are the advantages of Lookback.io over, I don't know, something like GoToMeeting?
It will organise all of your videos that it records and allow you to easily edit them down, right?
Yeah.
It'll also allow you to do both live moderated testing and self-testing. So you can send a URL out to a person and they just go ahead and do it by themselves.
Okay.
It's just got a really nice interface. It's, you know, super simple to use. It's designed specifically for this job. You know, it's like the difference in Photoshop and Sketch. You know, Photoshop's very powerful, but it's more generic, while Sketch was designed for web designers, you know?
Yep, cool. All right, I'll have a proper look at that.
Have a look, because you can get a free trial of it. Yep. They're not a sponsor, although they should be.
He said bitterly.
I don't think I've contacted them, actually. So, a few tips to get started with usability testing. First of all, do some preparation beforehand. It doesn't need to be anything great, but it's worth having a bit of a script together, especially at that introductory bit when you're talking about, you know, you've got to remind people to sign a, you know, disclosure form, or you want to, you know, reassure them that you're not testing them, or, you know, there are some basic bits and pieces that you want to kind of get in place. And then also you want a clear idea of what tasks you want them to do. I normally aim for about 3 tasks over a 40-minute session, about 10 minutes a task, and then an introduction and conclusion. But you can, you know, it depends on how long the task is, really.
That's not many.
You tend to do more?
Then I was thinking, well, it depends on what the task is, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does totally depend on the task. You know, if it's just something really simple.
My biggest problem, and I'm probably jumping ahead here, but my biggest problem with usability testing is I'm a terrible leader of the test.
Yes,
I have to sit on my hands and look the other way.
Almost. I know. But it's so easy. I this is why I don't do it very much anymore, if I'm honest, because I'm a very bad facilitator.
Because I'm good at making people feel comfortable and all that stuff, but it's sort of I just can't stop myself from helping them.
They'll ask a question as well, and you will answer it, and then realise, well, they're not going to have someone sitting in front of them, when they're doing it at home. And also, another way you can influence people very easily is by the way you word questions. You know, if you say things like, find out more about the company, right? They look for the word about, and you've led them, you know? So you've got to kind of word things very neutrally and that kind of stuff.
It's virtually impossible not to lead somebody, but it's just the level of how much you do it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
What you need to think about.
And also, it's being, and this is where I'm terrible, it's being comfortable with silences. And I want to fill silences all the time, but
me
sometimes
too.
You've got to let them do it, haven't you? You know, if you do fill a silence, you've got to be saying things like, "So, what are you thinking? What's going on in your head?" You know,
that's the most important question. Yeah, show me or tell me that kind of stuff. What are you thinking? They're the important questions.
The other one that I do quite a lot is that don't actually click on anything, but tell me what you'd click on, right? And then I say, "What do you expect to happen when you click on that?" That's a good question to ask.
Especially for labels.
Because, you know, what do you expect to see? So try not to influence people. The whole thing about making participants comfortable is a really good point. Because people do feel very uncomfortable. And then, of course, if they feel uncomfortable, they behave differently.
Yep.
So make them relax. Make it clear you're not testing them, right? You're testing the website. Lie through your teeth and pretend you weren't involved in the creation of the website in any way, because then they feel happy to slag it off in front of you. Because obviously, if they're paying you, you know, you're paying them money, you're giving them a gift, and that is something you should be doing, then they're going to be nice, right? But you need to make it clear that actually, if anything, you want to bias the other way. You want to say to people, look, we want to hear your negative feedback. We want to hear your problems.
Mm. Make up bad shit.
Make up bad, yeah. No, no, Marcus. Tell them, make sure you keep the sessions short, right? Because actually, it's quite a tiring thing to do, to ask people, you know. I think 40 minutes really is about as far as you can stretch people. Mm. You know, and also that way you can test with more people as well, which is better than doing long sessions with just one or two people.
Yeah, I agree.
So always record the sessions. You don't always watch those sessions back necessarily, depending on whether you've got someone in the room taking notes with you or someone in another room taking notes. But it's very good to be able to edit down afterwards,
yeah.
Right?
Don't record either video or audio and rely on those as your notes.
No.
Horrors. No. Horror of horror. You've basically just wasted a week of your life having to go back through it.
Yeah, because you've got to sit and go back through it.
Yeah, either you, which is not good, but you can't, I have done it, or preferably a colleague or somebody who works for the client you're working with, takes written, typed notes into a spreadsheet that you've prepared that is, you know, this is the task, these are the notes to go with that person, all that kind of thing. It's all beautifully laid out. And then you can kind of go back later and go through, let's say you're testing 10 people or 6 people, whatever. You can just go down through, what are the things I can pull out, because we're really good at doing that with words, out of this kind of list of all the stuff that you've got on that particular task that people were doing. But you'll also note to yourself, or the tester will say, when somebody said something brilliant. And that's when you go back in to the video and you pull that out show it to people.
You need to put timestamps. Yeah. When it, you know, you have those moments you go, well, that's interesting. Just make a note of the timestamp.
Yeah.
And again, that's why a tool like Lookback is really good, because I think it helps you do that. I can't remember exactly how, but I've got a feeling it did. So, yes, keep sessions short, always record them, run them regularly, right? You know, I'm a great believer in, you know, run them every month, because you're only talking about 3 people. You know, just test every month whatever it is you're currently doing, especially if you're working in-house. And Steve Krug talks about that in his second book, Rocket Surgery Made Easy. And he actually lays out a plan of how to do all of this kind of stuff, including scripts and everything else you need. So if you haven't read Rocket Surgery Made Easy, then I recommend that you get it. It's a really, really short book. It won't take you long to read it. So it's definitely worth checking out.
Yep.
The other thing that I did want to say, related to that, is I have actually written an introductory post that kind of summarizes everything that we've been talking about so far. So you might want to check out that as well. You can see that by going to boagworld.com/usability/usability-testing. And you might find that useful as well. Okay. Talking of testing brings us on nicely to full story, because there are some challenges with usability testing. One of the biggest challenges is getting access to your audience, right? People to test with. Now, we have said that you can go a long way towards doing that by just using any old random person, really, that isn't involved with the project. But let's be honest, it would be so much better if you could use real people that actually were, you know, were using your website. But, you know, when you ask on social media if people be willing to do it, you tend to attract people that either love or hate you as a company. Some companies are very precious about you bothering their customers, and especially salespeople can be very defensive about you talking to them. And even when you do get users to do usability testing, sometimes you can find they don't behave particularly naturally, you know, and they behave differently. So one thing that can be done to deal with that is session recorders, which is what Full Story does. A session recorder allows you to, you're obviously seeing real customers navigating around a website in real time. They're also making real decisions right? So they really are deciding whether to sign up for your newsletter. They really are deciding whether or not to add something to the shopping basket and so on. So there is a realness to session recorders that you don't get from usability testing. And of course, as well, you've got access to people very easily because it is the people using your website. Now, that said, session recorders don't replace usability testing, but they go very nicely and complement each other very well. So I recommend giving Full Story a go. You can sign up today and you get a free month of their pro account for free. No need for a credit card, and you can continue using them for free up to 1,000 sessions per month. To get all of that, go to fullstory.com/BOAG. So, that is usability testing. The other type of testing I wanted to touch on today was multivariate testing, A-B testing. Has Headscape done a lot of this kind of stuff with clients? You don't
Some, not a lot, some.
Yeah, because you don't do a huge amount with like e-commerce-y clients, do you?
Which I found this works, I mentioned labelling earlier. If you've got kind of, if a client can't decide what's, or I think a good example here, let's say a client uses a term that everyone internally within that organization understands, and they want to use that on their website because that's what the right word is. But actually there's a word that they consider to be a bit daft that actually is what the rest of the world thinks that thing is.
Yeah.
So that's when something like A-B testing comes into its own, because you can, you can basically, you've always said it, Paul, just let's test this, but that's a really good test. So you can just say, you know, all you're doing is, let's say it's a label on a navigation item, is your 50% of the audience goes to one, 50% goes to the other, and let's see how many click on it, and that is a genuine test. What I found with A-B testing is you go, yes, we can do an A-B test on this, and you go, what are we actually testing?
Yeah.
We want to change the colour of this page, and it's like, but how
so
are
how
we going
to
know?
Yeah, which is the better one, yeah.
So
it's a very interesting one, A-B testing. That is one common problem, is not being very clear about what it is that you're testing. The other is not having enough traffic to get statistically accurate results. So, I mean, let's back up just a second, right? So there's A-B testing and there's multivariate testing. They are very similar to one another, but if we're going to be picky, we'll define the difference. So A-B testing is where you are testing one element of a page. So, for example, you mentioned label on navigation. Mm-hmm. That would be A-B testing, right? Multivariate testing is where you're changing multiple elements on a page, right?
Isn't that funny? That's not what I thought it meant.
No, I know. This is where it causes a lot of confusion. A lot of people, and I did for a long time, a lot of people think A-B testing is you've got one variation. Yeah. And multivariant is you have multiple variations. But actually, it's not according to Google's definition of it, as far as I understand
read. Google's talking silly stuff.
I know. I've seen different people say different things, right?
But anyway,
which is why I wanted to clarify it for our purposes. Who knows what the right answer is, right? I'll have a load of hate either way. You'll get hate mail. I'll get hate mail. Both of us are wrong.
I can live with it.
Yeah, so can I. Especially if we don't actually tell people how they email us.
Yeah.
Although that boat has probably sailed. Right, so because it's so confusing, because there's all this kind of stuff, right, it's very tempting not to do it and not to try. But actually getting started is, who gives a shit about the terminology, right? And, it's actually very simple to get started.
Yep.
I recommend getting started just using something called Google Optimize, right? Google Optimize is a free product, integrates well with Google Analytics and all the rest of it, but who cares about that? It just makes it really easy to get started with usability testing. So, multivariate testing. So, I wanted to test various wording for my newsletter sign up on my website. So you add a bit of JavaScript to your to my website, and then you log into Google Optimize. You create a test, and then it uses what's currently there as a base value, loads up the page. You define, you've got like a WYSIWYG editor. You can go in, you can change the wording, you know, change what's on the button, etc. Just in a WYSIWYG editor, hit save, job done. Simple as that. Really is very, very straightforward. And you can create multiple versions of that if you want to, or you can edit multiple elements of the newsletter sign-up form. So I might want to change the button and the text and the title, or just the title or whatever, right?
Yep.
Now, there is limitations to this. And the limitations come around in order to be sure that one version is performing over another, you need a certain number of conversions, right? A certain number of people that have taken whatever you defined your action as, right? So in my case, it would be, say, submitting that newsletter field, right? So again, you need to be clearly defining what your testing is, you know, what you're trying to improve. Mm. The problem is that you don't always know whether you've got enough traffic, you know, you're not getting statistically accurate enough results, right? Because you've got low levels of traffic, so you're not getting enough conversions. It's only once you've got a certain number of conversions, you know whether it's effective or not. So how do you deal with sites that have got lower levels of traffic? Well, I mean, one response is to say, well, you just have to be patient, right? Who's got time for that? I don't want to wait 3-4 months to know whether something has worked or not. You know, I'm too impatient for that. One option, therefore, is to reduce your statistical certainty, right? So you can say, well, you know, as long as I've got over this number of people and, you know, there's this big enough difference between the two, then that's good enough, right?
Okay.
That's okay.
Depends what you're testing, though, doesn't it?
It does. Well, yes and no. Yeah, of course it does, you know. But actually, don't forget, if you've got a low level of traffic, the stakes are lower, right?
This is true.
So you can afford to take a few more liberties, my point. If you wouldn't want to do that if you were Amazon, but you wouldn't need to do it if you're Amazon, because you're going to get so much traffic and so much conversion that you could have a high level of statistical certainty. Yeah. The trouble is that A-B, you know, all the people that write about A-B testing are all the kind of, oh, you know, we're big and professional. So they set the bar very high. It's just like usability testing. When you read a lot about usability testing, they make it sound hard because they're professionals in that and they're setting the bar high. And so you should set the bar high if you can, but we can't all. So reducing the statistical certainty is one way of getting around it. But if you reacted like Marcus, feeling slightly uncomfortable with that idea, there are other alternatives available to you. One is you should only test a single variation. So if you think about it, if you've got 100% of your audience and you're testing four different versions, that means only 25% of your very limited audience is going to see each version. Right. If you're testing between two versions, 50%, so double the number of people are going to hit that. Right. So the fewer versions you test, the more the quicker you're going to get to that statistically significant threshold. Does that make sense, Marcus?
Yes, totally.
Good. I didn't know whether, you know, when you say something and it doesn't, you know, you're not sure whether it's clear. So now that's the complete opposite of what you'd want to do if you have a high performing website, because in a high performing website, if you have five or six variations, then you're going to much more likely to find the best solution possible, right? And it actually, you're more likely to increase your conversion rate higher. But we don't all have that luxury. So a single variation is good when you've got low traffic. Another option is to test close to the point of conversion. So what do I mean by that? Well, let's say, for example, you were trying to increase the number of people signing up to your newsletter on your blog, right? Just like I was saying a minute ago. If I start testing, oh, I wonder what blog post titles have the biggest impact on conversion rate, right? There's quite a big distance in terms of user journey between seeing a blog post title and then going and actually pressing the submit button. However, if instead I test the text that's immediately around the newsletter sign up button, right, when people are already thinking about signing up for the newsletter, there is a much shorter gap, right?
Yeah.
And so that's a good way of increasing the conversion rate for the particular element you're trying to test, okay? But what if you want to test blog post titles, right? That doesn't help you then, does it? So the flip side of that is you test micro conversions. So because you can't test the long journey, like from there to newsletter sign up, instead you might want to say, okay, well, I want to know which are the best performing blog post titles, right? The more people that view a blog post, the more likely they are eventually to sign up to a newsletter. So what I want to find out is which blog post titles encourage the most click-throughs to read the blog post. Right. Ah, okay. Now we can test that. So instead of testing the newsletter sign-up button, we test the number of click-throughs instead because that's closer. Yep. Does that make sense?
Totally.
Oh, good. I managed to get through that because it's quite a confusing thing to explain. So the most important thing to say about multivariate testing is if you've got low levels of traffic, absolutely give it a go, but just don't rely just on A-B testing. Do a bit of usability testing as well. And to be honest, I think that applies on every site. I see a lot of really high-end sites with lots of traffic that rely so heavily on usability testing that they're not really picking up on some of the qualitative data that you get from usability testing. So you've got to mix your different approaches. Now, I've written an article on this one as well, boagworld.com/design/split-testing. So there's a little bit about that.
Cool.
So hopefully that encourages you to have a little go on those two areas, and it will make an enormous difference to your conversion rate. Because to be honest, we're all making it up. We're all guessing what might convert well and what might not. And the only way to be sure is to actually test. Marcus, do you have a joke to wrap us up with?
I do. One second. This is from James Sheesby Thomas. Why don't communists drink loose leaf tea?
Because why don't communists drink loose leaf tea?
Because proper tea is theft.
I don't get
property.
That one.
Property is theft.
Property. Oh.
Yeah, come on, that's quite good. Well, yeah, you're just embarrassed you didn't get it.
No, well, it's more that I was already thinking about where I want to go next in Red Dead. So my mind
is
moved
on. You can do that now. Bye.
All right, so bye. On that basis, I'm off back to my holiday, and we shall talk again next week. But until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Holy crap.